Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, Chapter entitled The Forest of Enjoyment. Text 13. Because it's prose, I'll just chant by myself the shloka, and then we can do the word for word responsively. Ekadasat prasangam yukrita matir yudaka shota skala navad ubayot jopi dukadam pagandam abhidyati ekada. Sometimes asat prasangat, by the association of non-devotees who are against the Vedic principles and who manufacture different paths of religion. Ikritamati, whose intelligence has been brought to the abominable status of defying the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yudaka Shota, into rivers without sufficient water. Skalanavat, like jumping. Ubayator, from both sides. Api, although. Dukadam, giving distress. Pakandam, the atheistic path. Abhiyati, he approaches. Translation of purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes, to mitigate distresses in this forest of the material world, the conditioned soul receives cheap blessings from atheists. He then loses all intelligence in their association. This is exactly like jumping in a shallow river. As a result, one simply breaks his head. He's not able to mitigate his sufferings from the heat, and in both ways he suffers. The misguided conditioned soul who approaches so-called sadhus and swamis who preach against the principles of the Vedas. The misguided conditioned soul also approaches so-called swamis and sadhus and swamis who preach against the principles of the Vedas. He does not receive benefit from them, either in the present or in the future. Purport. Cheaters are always there to manufacture their own way of spiritual realization. To get some benefit, the conditioned soul approaches these pseudo-swamis and yogis for cheap blessings. But he does not receive any benefit from them, either spiritual or material. In this age, there are many cheaters who show some jugglery and magic. They even create gold to amaze their followers. Maybe Krishna's arrangement. Everyone left. And their followers accept them as God. This type of cheating is very prominent in Kali Yuga. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes the real guru in this way. Samsaradava nanalita loka trinayakaruna ganaganatum praptashakalyana gunanavasha vandegaroshi charanaravindam. One should approach a guru who can extinguish the blazing fire of this material world, the struggle for existence. People want to be cheated, and therefore they go to yogis and swamis who play tricks. But tricks do not mitigate the miseries of material life. If being able to manufacture gold is a criterion for becoming God, then why not accept Krishna, the proprietor of the entire universe, wherein there are countless tons of gold? As mentioned before, the color of gold is compared to the will-o'-the-wisp, or yellow stool. Therefore, one should not be allured by gold manufacturing gurus, but should sincerely approach a devotee like Judd Barrett. Judd Barrett instructed Rahugana Maharaj so that the king was relieved from the bodily conception. One cannot become happy by accepting a false guru. The guru should be accepted as advised in Srimad Bhagavatam 11.321, Tajmat Gurum Prapadyeta Jigneshu Shreya Uttama. One should approach a bona fide guru to inquire about the highest benefit of life. Such a guru is described as follows: Shabde Pare Chanishnatam. Such a guru does not manufacture gold or juggle words. He is well versed in the conclusion of Vedic knowledge, Vaidaischa Saver Ahameva Vedya. He is freed from all material contamination. He is fully engaged in Krishna's service. If one is able to obtain the dust of the lotus feet of such a guru, his life becomes successful. Otherwise, he is baffled both in this life and in the next. Translation again. Sometimes to mitigate distresses in this forest of the material world, the conditioned soul receives cheap blessings from atheists. He then loses all intelligence in their association. This is exactly like jumping in a shallow river. As a result, one simply breaks his head. He's not able to mitigate his sufferings from the heat, and in both ways he suffers. The misguided conditioned soul also approaches so-called sadhus and swamis who preach against the principles of the Vedas. He does not receive benefit from them, either in the present or in the future. Om Agyanatim Anandasya Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Umlitam Gina Tajmai Shri Guruve Namaha. So Srila Prabhupada often spoke about this world as being a place of the cheaters and the cheated. So it's not a material formula to meet a bona fide spiritual master. And one who decides, as the analogy in the verse goes, decides to jump into a river which is shallow and consequently breaks his head. In other words, one who accepts a bogus guru, it's because of a lack of qualification. So that may seem like an odd statement, but if we analyze it from the standpoint of Rupa Goswami's instructions in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu regarding the eligibility for taking up devotional service, it's based upon, does anybody know? This is not an often known subject, how it is that devotees take up the process of devotional service. By the mercy. You have to say it in more American English. I'm a little bewildered by the French English. Okay. One more try. Yeah. Okay, that's there. That's a given. But there's a little bit more to it than that. Yes, Prabhu. Okay. Want to give, say the whole thing and give the translation. It's a significant point. Can you give me a more exact translation? Because it's significant. It's a springboard for further discussions because Prabhupada was asked a question about this. Those who have acted piously in this life and in the previous life and are free from sin, right? Yeah, so then they're eligible to take up devotional service. And so one disciple on a morning walk said to Srila Prabhupada, but what about us, Prabhupada? We haven't acted piously. We haven't been free from sin in this life. We don't know what happened last life. And Prabhupada said, I have created your good karma. But there is a distinction about what this good karma is. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his commentary on Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I believe it's in chapter 22, Madhya 22, he describes three kinds of sukriti. What is sukriti? That's pious activities. Okay, there's three kinds of sukriti. And of the three, there's only one that leads to devotional service. The others lead elsewhere. Okay, so, yes, Mataji? Okay, okay. Well, if one takes prasadam, then? Well, you're on the right track. You're on the right track. I'll give you a little bit more technical details on this. There's bhagan mukhi sukriti. This is pious activity that leads to increased sense enjoying facilities. Okay? So in other words, take the example of our ISKCON Ambarish Prabhu. And he was born into, as they say, there's an American colloquialism, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Maybe even a gold adorned with diamonds. Spoon in his mouth. So when someone Janmaishvaya Shruta Shribir Edamana Mada Puman, there are four kinds of material opulences. High birth. Okay, so someone's born in a family of royalty, great wealth, bodily beauty, and high education. These come about as a result of Bhagan Mukhi Sukriti. And then there's mokshan mukhi sukriti. These are pious activities that lead to what? Huh? Yeah. And this may not be devotional. It wouldn't be devotional liberation. It would be impersonal liberation. Ye nye ravandaksha vimukti maninas tvayashtad bhavarava shudabudaya aruya kuchena parampadampata padantyado nadita yushmad angriya. So this describes from the 10th canto, 14th chapter, it describes how one yene ravandaksha vimukti maninas twayashtad babarava shuddha buddhaya aruya krichena. So it's an imagined platform of liberation where they're, have somehow or other by their austerities and studying or practicing jnana yoga, they've become detached from their subtle and gross bodies. And they've understood the eternality of their existence, but they haven't understood that jivara sarupa hoy krishnara nishcha das, that they're eternal servants of Krishna. So it's an imagined platform, and it's because of a failure to have attachment for the lotus feet of the Lord, it's unstable. They're not really satisfied as the soul can be satisfied in its original position at the lotus feet of the Lord, where they're just incredibly blissful. So it's a situation where they're freed temporarily from suffering. A little hard to understand, but it's imaginary, and people that are in that situation often become prideful, and they usually fall down. We see many examples. Prabhupada uses examples of these impersonal sannyasis, and they come to the level of mundane social welfare work. They open hospitals and schools, and Ramakrishna Mission is a case in point. They're have very developed educational facilities in India, And then, what really counts, and this is what Tulsi Priya Mataji was touching upon, is bhaktyan mukhi sukriti. This is pious activities that actually have devotional content. And they may be performed, as you were saying, on the platform of a gata sukriti. Not necessarily. One can do gata sukriti. Devotional activities that eventually, it's like putting deposits in a bank account, a devotional bank account. So, you can all probably look back at your lives prior to becoming a devotee and recognize junctures where you came in contact with. It always has to involve, and this is another point that's correct, that Dr. Rami Prabhu made, is that it will involve, as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur clarifies in Madhurya Kandambini, it involves a Madhyama Vaishnava. Necessarily, it has to involve. Now, it could be an extension of a Madhyama Vaishnava. Now, that Madhyama Vaishnava may have descended from the Uttama Vaishnava platform to preach, as in the case of Srila Prabhupada, and the extension of that Madhyama, who may be a Kanishta, who's out distributing books and connects with someone, brings them to the temple. But the ultimate need to gain a Gata Sukriti is some kind of a connection with a Madhyama Vaishnava. And then one may see a devotee. The general prescription, although there are exceptions to the rule, there's two places in Shastra where it's described that Krishna can directly give the mercy and one can take up. So Shastra, Prabhupada says in a Bhagavad Gita purport that sometimes one can directly take up Krishna consciousness from reading Bhagavad Gita. Ultimately, with that, if it's Bhagavad Gita as it is, it has the hand of Shakta Vaishavatar, Uttama Vaishnava, who's come to the Madhyama platform to preach. But generally speaking, it comes about as a result of some contact with a Madhyama Vaishnava, and there's an appreciative mood. Like, I remember the first time I saw devotees, I was, I hope this doesn't bring out any kind of fault-finding tendencies, but I was in the hippie subculture. I mean, I deserve as many fault-finding mentalities as possible to reduce my false ego directed at me. But I had a beard down to the middle of my chest and hair down to the middle of my back and a ponytail. And I was visiting my brother who was at, doing graduate work at Harvard, and we passed devotees. This is probably in 1972. And we passed devotees that were chanting in the Boston Commons in Boston, Massachusetts, United States. And my brother, as we walked by them, they looked extremely blissful. And in those days, the preaching, the main preaching that was going on in our movement, that the devotees would go out 10 to 12 hours a day on Harinam Sankirtan. So as we passed them, my brother said, oh, look at the Hare Krishnas. They look so spaced out. And in my mind, I said, my God, they look really far out. You know, they look really great. So this was my first deposit in my Bhaktian Mukhi Sukriti account. And then, you know, another time, I was, this was in another location, at the big university, Syracuse University, there I found out that the Hare Krishnas were offering free prasadam. You know, so I was kind of like, you know, I was very deeply immersed in the hippie subculture in America at the time. And so I said, oh, free, something free, good feast. So I showed up, and they were, had a slideshow going on. And I fell asleep. Just laid down on the floor and went to sleep. And then I might have even been snoring, for all I know. But after the, you know, at one point, a devotee woke me up, and I just was so impressed with the level of kindness that this devotee had. And I remember it was some papadums and guacamole dip. Guacamole is like avocado. It's a Mexican, you know. And it was just like, phew, it was just so good. And I think there was like a lassi, like a mango lassi drink. And I didn't know anything about the philosophy, but it just was, I was just impressed by the tenderheartedness of this devotee that just woke me up and was so kind. Would you like something to eat? And I even thought that it might have been because Satsarup Maharaj in those days was heading up the library party, and they would meet with the you know, like Bhakti Tirtha Swami, and Sureshwara Prabhu was on this, and Shesha Prabhu was on this, and you know, Sahotra Prabhu was on the library party. I mean, there was some really big guns. And they became big guns. And I thought after, I had no idea who it was that woke me up. But I kind of because what they would do, Satsarup Maharaj, he didn't do so much distribution. He just kind of maintained everyone's consciousness. And then they would have programs. And I don't think Satsarup Maharaj was one of the salesmen, but he would travel with the group. And then they would fan out and the different salespeople. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami was the best. You know, I mean, he performed these severe austerities, and he'd go in, and he would just charm these professors. And then they'd sell full sets. But they would also have these other programs. So I thought to myself, kind of after the fact, that maybe it was Satsarup Maharaj, because he is known for that kind of kindness, you know, just such a soft-hearted Vaishnava, that he might have been the one who woke me up then and later as well. So then the next juncture was that I had, and that was a fairly substantial deposit. Then I had a slight withdrawal. I was on in the streets in New York City, and there was an extremely aggressive Sankirtan devotee that came up to me and tried to sell me a BTG, and I was like, ah! And it was a little bit over the top for me. The skills hadn't been fully developed in this person. It might have been one of his first times out or something, but he was just like, he was practically beating me over the head with a Back to Godhead magazine. So I wasn't so favorably disposed on that one. But then the next time that I had a deposit was probably about six, seven years later. And I traveled, I was living in a very remote area of the United States in the state of Vermont, and I traveled to Montreal with my girlfriend to enjoy for the weekend. And all we did was fight the whole time. And then when we were about ready to come back, I was in the Montreal bus station. I mean, I was like completely fried, you know, and I saw this completely transcendentally peaceful Mataji wearing a sari distributing books in the Montreal bus station. So I went up to her, and my mode in those days was to get everything for free. So she was trying to sell me a Bhagavad Gita, and I was trying to convince her to give it to me for free. And she ended up giving me a King of Knowledge, and she gave it to me for free, if I promised that I would read it. And I was super determined to read it because I was so disturbed, you know, by this woman that the material energy had sent me to torture me. And so I read the book on the bus ride back to the United States. It was about a 4-5 hour ride to Burlington, Vermont. And it was like amazing. I felt like the bus had taken off. It wasn't even touching the highway anymore. You know, it was just like, ooh. You know, and my consciousness, you know, of course, I would evaluate alterations in my consciousness on the basis of, you know, how high I was. You know, this was kind of the standard, you know, amongst the hippies. And this was probably the best high I'd ever experienced. But what was unique about it was that also philosophically I really connected with what I read. The one thing that I couldn't connect with, and it really piqued my curiosity, was within the King of Knowledge is this Sakshi Gopal pastime that's described. And first of all, you know, here I was, raised in a Christian country. Thou shalt not worship craven images before me, right? You know, it's idolatry. And so here's this deity that walks half the way across India bearing witness for this Brahmin. And this is something that just was unknown to me. But I wanted to ask more, but I'd lived in the middle of nowhere, so there was no one to ask. But I could see that after receiving this book, my life went through some major changes. Shortly after that, I met this Kundalini yogi. I won't tell that whole story. The devotees that attended my Bhakta class heard that one. That would go beyond the scope of our timeline. Speaking of timeline, I don't have much more time left. But anyway, you know, from at that point, I'm making these points because I think you can all reflect on it because it's an important aspect of our philosophy to understand. Because here we have so many visitors coming. If we can be instrumental in providing them with facility to make deposits in their Bhaktianmukhi Sukriti account, it's a very pleasing service to Krishna. And that's one of the main functions that Radhadesh Project seems to have fallen into by Krishna's arrangement to give this access to Bhaktianmukhi Sukriti to thousands of people every year. So it's a very significant thing that it's favorably, you know, that they walk away with a very, very favorable attitude, because what could come from that is down the road, you know, they'll start going through some major transformations internally. What happened with me was after I got that book, I moved to vegetarianism. I had this experience with this Kundalini yogi, which made me more curious. I started reading all kinds of books on Indian spirituality. And then 1 year before I joined, I started praying to God, not Krishna, but God in general, please direct me to my guru. And then this like amazing event took place, which brought me to the movement. So if you look back at your own lives, you'll see that there are different junctures where you had positive experiences with devotees, but that leads you to the point where you become qualified to take up devotional service. And I don't know the verse, but from the 11th canto, 2nd chapter, there's a verse that describes the attributes of one who's qualified to take up devotional service. Somehow or other, by good fortune, one develops a taste or some faith in hearing about the transcendental pastimes of the Lord. He's neither too attached to material enjoyment nor too detached. Now this may sound a little quizzical. How is it that these are further, like kind of fine-tuned qualifications that one must be in this stage just prior to taking up Vaidhisadhana Bhakti. So not too attached, not too detached. If someone would be too detached from the material energy, what would his likely trajectory be in life? Anybody? I'm just trying to keep everybody awake here. Huh? If he's too detached, that's a possibility, very strong possibility. He's suffered so damn much. I said, let me put an end to the whole thing. Bhagavati Mataji? That's correct. He wants to negate his personalism because it's just too damn tough to be a person. That's the kind of mindset that unfolds if he's gone too much suffering and he's too detached. I don't want it. You know, so he commits spiritual suicide by going into impersonal philosophy. Takes up a bogus guru, maybe, you know, like that's described here. It's a fine-tuned position that one must be in. And as a result, we see there's a description in Chaitanya Charitamrita that the rarity of taking up devotional service can be compared to a turtle surfacing. You know, the turtles can surface anywhere in the ocean, but he just happens to surface and stick his head up through a knot hole in a board. Okay? There's a lot of places in the ocean that one can stick his head up. But this turtle, somehow or other, by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, sticks his head up through this knot hole in a board that's floating on the ocean. So it's very rare. But, you know, the one point is that in Kali Yuga, because of the incredible mercy that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has provided to the inhabitants of Kali Yuga, and his Shaktivesh avatar, Srila Prabhupada, who has devised, because of his great love for his Guru Maharaj and the Parampara and for Krishna, and his deep compassion for the conditioned souls, he's devised incredibly ingenious means for planting or for enabling people to take these bhakti-mukhi sukriti steps towards taking up Vaidhisadhana Bhakti. Hare Krishna. Okay, and I haven't said anything bad about anybody in this class, even though the verse and purport would, because you never know who might be listening on a loudspeaker. So let us stop now if there's any questions or comments. Hare Krishna. Yes, Mataji. So those good causes, they may not lead to bhakti. They may lead to increased sense enjoyment and further entanglement in the material world. Still in all, maybe I interrupted you prematurely. I'm sorry. It's American lack of etiquette. Go ahead. Why don't you finish your question? Okay, can you back up a little bit more in American English, less German English? Kind of lost it. Yeah. So then why is this kind of a gradation down? There's different levels of surrender that Krishna gives in 12th chapter, right? Okay, yeah, so a good question. And, Srila Prabhupada, in one letter, it's a famous letter. I wish I could quote the exact date of this letter. But he delineates between philosophical speculation and mental speculation. Mental speculation is based upon just one's intelligence and one's own intelligence, and he's just trying to figure it out without any reference to guru, sadhu, and shastra. Okay? Something that we shouldn't do. Okay? Philosophical speculation, in this particular letter, sometimes Prabhupada speaks in a denigrating way of philosophical speculation, but in this particular letter, he describes this as a favorable activity for devotees to engage in, where they, on the basis of guru, sadhu, and shastra, one tries to understand the philosophy and come closer to Krishna. Okay? So we may not know the exact answer to your question, right? You may not know. But in this case, philosophical speculation would be a good activity to engage in because we're trying to understand the philosophy that's given to us. And, sometimes, there, particularly with Bhaktivedanta College students who have their intelligence activated in terms of delving deeply into the philosophy, they may come up with questions that may be gaps, in the philosophical presentations that are given. So then you have to piece together aspects of the philosophy to come up with an understanding. And that's something that's legitimate. Our acharyas do it. They'll make a philosophical point and they'll support it with references from different places. So, everyone ready to philosophically speculate? Okay? No problems? Okay? No one's going to throw rotten tomatoes at the Bhagavatam class speaker if he does this? Or take out emotional machine guns and let him have it? So, we can understand that with this verse, what is that, this verse that you quoted from Gita? This is from which chapter? That's 7th chapter, right? 7:28. That one who has acted piously in this lifetime. Now, you see, one real beautiful thing about Rupa Goswami, of course, he was empowered. Just as Krishna empowered Lord Brahma with Vedic knowledge within the heart, Lord Chaitanya empowered Rupa Goswami with Vedic knowledge within the heart. The beautiful thing about Rupa Goswami's writing is that it's extremely precise. Like his definition of Uttama Bhakti gives such detail, there's no question about what it means to be on the pure devotional platform. It's extremely helpful for a sadhaka. So he can direct, he can function within parameters that are extremely beneficial. He can practice Uttama Bhakti even in a Kanishta platform by isolating himself from his material desires and not be driven by them. So Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that statement, this piety. Now that could be any one of those three pieties. And here, and also in chapter 12, it seems that it's kind of an open door. One who, then one should perform pious activities. And how is that delineated? What kind of pious activities are like kind of a notch down in surrender? Maybe some charitable works or... I'm not sure, I can't remember. Are you researching that now as I'm talking? Well, get going, Bubba. Okay. You're not paying attention. No. The piety that is described in the 12th chapter, there's different levels. If you can't do this, then do this. And you can't do that, then do this. So he kind of brings it down to a notch where just, can you just at least be a good person? You know, and do, it seemed, in my recollection, you kind of that you do social welfare activities for others, you know, feed hungry people, plant trees. Is it? Yoga? Okay. So, yeah, so Nishkam Karma Yoga. But so that's still giving up the results, but who do you give the results up to? So that, no, it does matter, because it may be that you give it up to Krishna. No, okay, so that's just standard Nishkam Karma Yoga, without having Krishna as a goal. And then there's a purification that takes place with that, because there's an awakening of Gyan. There's an awakening of Gyan, and as that Gyan awakens, one understands not his body. What happens oftentimes with people that are on that path, say of Gyan Yoga or of Karma Yoga, they come in contact with Bhakti Yogis. This is also described. Actually, my recollection is described by Burijan in his commentary in this section of the Yoga Ladder in his Surrender Unto Me. But I would presume that that's drawn from the commentaries of the Acharyas and also maybe Prabhupada's purporting somewhere. But that's... So in other words, by doing these kind of activities, that's the lowest step on the ladder of... Okay, so basically this is an encapsulized yoga ladder, okay? And so the yoga ladder basically involves, you know, the traditional yoga ladder is not a one-shot, one-lifetime deal. It's a multiple-lifetime experience, generally speaking. So, and, you know, bhakti doesn't come until the top of the yoga ladder. Right? After Gyan, or after Astanga, after Astanga Yoga. So, I mean, it can, you know, but then, you see, but the merciful Acharya, like Srila Prabhupada, has given access to the express elevator at every step of the yoga ladder. So one might philosophically speculate, because there's a certain kind of trajectory that one takes up in life of not being the center of the universe, right? And so that creates some favorability in terms of accessing, just like there's a certain group that's here and they get to associate and take Krishna Prasadam, and in Bhakti and Mukhi Sukriti, we deal with them nicely. We don't say harsh things from the Bhagavatam Asana. You know, shanti, shanti. And, you know, Bhaktin Mukhi Sukriti Ki Jai. So, you get the point? So there's a certain trajectory that people start. You know, and Krishna can, there's another analysis, Brahmanda Brahmate Kona Bhagavang Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Paya Bhakti Lata Beach. Let's say, so then there's also, generally speaking, the credit is given to the Madhyama Adhikari to seeing a candidate, praying to Krishna for his deliverance, and then the process begins. That's when the Bhakti Lata Beach is planted in the heart because of the Madhyama. But also, Krishna can see this person is ready, and then he makes arrangements for him to meet the Madhyama Adhikari, Madhyama Vaishnava. Okay, have I clarified or have I confused the issues? Huh? Clarified? Okay. Any other points? Yes? Well, that's how it really works, because it's the Madhyama Vaishnava that makes the Bhakti and Mukhi Sukriti work. Without the Madhyama, and he did. You know, all the books, all the Prasadam distribution, all the Harinams. Well, yeah, it's either directly or indirectly. That's how it comes, you know. I mean, practically speaking, you know, because he's the foundational Shiksha Guru for all of ISKCON, we can attribute all of our devotional service to him. You know, the startup of our devotional service. It goes, you know, that's the Parampara system, but because his instructions, his presence is so all-pervasive in ISKCON, you know, and it's really very favorable to our devotional service to put that relationship in a very prominent position within our hearts. That doesn't preclude or in any way hint at Ritvik philosophy. It doesn't preclude, you know, a very powerful relationship with one Diksha's guru. But this is the uniqueness of devotional service, that we can have multiple relationships and they can be beneficial. We have one Diksha guru relationship, which can be a very prominent Shiksha, usually it is, Shiksha guru relationship, Shiksha relationship. But we can also have a very, very prominent relationship with the founder Acharya, like Ramanuja Acharya and his Sampradaya. Everyone right from the very beginning is directed in a relationship with Ramanuja Acharya, but they still maintain a very healthy, respectful, and can be very deep relationship with their Shiksha Guru or Diksha Gurus. Okay? Yes. Now, is there some time where I've got to keep my mouth shut so that I don't get in trouble with, you know, everyone's, the fire in their bellies and, you know, the different demigods and temple presidents and temple managers? Huh? I reach the that's the cutoff time, and then I turn into a big pumpkin if I speak longer. Okay, so should we give special dispensation to like such a sincere soul as Jadarani Mataji to ask her question? Yeah. Now, remember, Ami Puran Manush Mataji, so. King Niga, yeah. There's a mix-up. He took something back or something, right? He gave a yeah. But did the punishment lead to bhakti? Did the punishment lead to bhakti? Sometimes, you know, the curse of a Brahmin. Like, for instance, Nala Kuvera and Manigriva. You know, they were in a drunken condition and Narada Muni shows up and they were, you know, they were cavorting with some heavenly damsels. They were in a disgusted, degraded condition. And Narada Muni cursed them to be trees, but they got the darshan of Lord Krishna and became liberated. So sometimes the curses of Brahmins are devotionally favorable. I mean, I've been, you know, I don't know if I've been exactly cursed, but I've sure gotten some exalted devotees pretty upset with me. And, you know, whew-wee. And, you know, it seems like my whole world is coming to an end. But, and they, you know, when I get through the storm, you know, I've found out that actually it was quite a blessing. You see my point? Okay. Oh, so these were Jagyak Brahmanas, right? Well, even so, you know, if it was done if the curse was done according to Vedic prescription, you know, probably some benefit, because ultimately it's coming from the Lord. Can you speak a little bit louder? That's Bhaktin Mukhi Sukriti. Yeah. Right. It can be what? Yeah, that could be, but it also could be that there's some pious activity that eventually detaches him more from enjoying the fruits of his own labor, and then there's a certain, you know, if it's done, like the yoga ladder is based upon the Karma Yoga section, and even the Karma Kanda is based upon an intact Vedic culture, where they're doing everything, jagnartat karmano yatra lokoyam karma bandana, you know, for the pleasure of, the ultimate beneficiary is Krishna, or is Vishnu. So then there's a kind of a subtle purification, even though there's the offerings made to the demigods. So in the absence of that Vedic culture, then, you know, we may donate to some soup kitchen that serves meat, and, you know, it's pretty, you know, questionable how much piety we're accumulating with that. And that's what a lot of these charities do. You know, they're bogus, completely contradictory to the Vedas. So in that case, you know, probably the, you know, anyway, Hare Krishna. I think we've philosophically speculated sufficiently and said that we got the basic point, you know. And, yes, Prabhu? Yeah, usually the knowledge is that I'm eternal. The kind of knowledge that's referred to in Jnana Yoga is that I'm an eternal living entity, that I'm... that's the first step of knowledge, you know, that, what's the verse? I can't think of it now. When I was teaching the yoga letter, I would know it. But, you know, that's the first step, you know, to know what this, the difference between what's eternal and what's asat. So that's the first, you know, and that's by the neti-neti process, one can come to that level of understanding what's eternal and what's not. And so that's a preliminary stage of, you know, kind of one begins to recognize the existence of the soul. And one can't go further than that except through Shastric study or the mercy of Vaishnavas. To understand that I'm an eternal servant of Krishna requires Vaishnava mercy. Okay? Bhagavad Prabhupada, Hare Krishna.